Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Friday on the Other Side here at Mind Talk. Every Friday, we take a look at events, experiences, all kinds of things that may not initially appear to have a mental health focus or impact, but in fact do. Today's conversation is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you the first of today's guests, Dr. E. Muscal, who is a pediatric rheumatologist at Texas Children's Hospital and an associate professor at Baylor College of Medicine. And what is Dr. Muscal going to be talking to us about today? Autoimmune encephalitis. Dr. Muscal, thank you very much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Pleasure is all mine.
Now, Dr. Muscal, let's start from the very beginning with what is autoimmune encephalitis?
It appears to be a disorder like other autoimmune conditions where the body by mistake makes certain proteins or antibodies that are, instead of fighting infections, end up turning on the body itself, and in this condition make their way to the brain and get in the way of how certain parts of the body of the brain communicate with each other, affecting certain neurotransmitter structures or parts of the neurons.
So what would that look like? Is there a particular pattern of behaviors or symptoms that are present for someone who has autoimmune encephalitis?
Yes, there is, though these conditions are really new to medicine, perhaps not to man and womankind, but one of the more common of these is called NMDA receptor encephalitis, and it's only been able to be tested for since 2007, which is a millisecond in the scope of medicine and science. But in many of these conditions, you have a constellation of signs and symptoms that include confusion. Sometimes in medicine, that's called encephalopathy. Behavior changes, that can be acute onset of depression or psychosis, children and adults hearing voices seeing things that aren't there, seizures, and abnormal movements, so tremors or movements called chorea, or a variety of other movements that are not under the control of the person. That is sort of in the most common NMDA receptor encephalitis. The hallmark of all of these is that they're acute or subacute, so not someone who has chronic mental health issues or chronic neurologic issues all their life, but something starts out of the blue within a 1 to 3 month period before coming to medical attention.
Well, you know, as you were describing, certainly some of what look like the psychiatric presentations, the first thing that I think about is, oh, well, this is somebody who's psychotic, except for the seizures. This is somebody who's psychotic. This is somebody who perhaps has schizophrenia. I mean, this is somebody who clearly has a psychiatric diagnosis. And if I only paid attention to that, I would be flat out wrong.
You are correct. This is a disease that, for good or bad, really makes physicians and mental health practitioners be at their A game, going to their meetings and increasing awareness in disorders that are new to all of our specialties, to our medical students and nursing students. And you really have to be aware enough and cognizant enough that there is something different than your usual, if there is such a thing, run-of-the-mill patient with their first break, you know, the first psychotic break, or with depression that has some psychotic features to it. And those nuggets, those pearls that make you think, wow, I need to get some of my collaborators or my friends involved who I work with, is that there are episodes that appear to be neurologically based. So perhaps confusion, you know, episodes where a family might say, yeah, I know he's acting strange, but leading up to things, he actually intermittently seemed like he was on drugs, if I didn't know better. You know, he was sleeping too much, or perhaps they noticed abnormal movements. Obviously, if someone has seizures, that gets them to medical attention and hopefully gets them a diagnosis even quicker.
Is there a particular age in which this is more or less likely to be diagnosed? And is there a particular gender who is more or less likely to be affected?
So again, it's a difficult question because the epidemiology, the fancy word for what do we know about prevalence of disorders, is really not where it needs to be in this disease. We know the most about NMDA receptor encephalitis. That's sort of the story in Brain on Fire, a really lovely book and upcoming movie that's coming out, that appears to be the most common of these. There's only been one study out of research group called the California Encephalitis Study that seems compelling or asks the question about how often do people have NMDA receptor encephalitis and states that perhaps young people have NMDA receptor encephalitis more than viral encephalitis. So viral infections that cause inflammation in the brain. So 4 times more than viruses like herpes or varicella or West Nile virus in certain parts of the country. It appears to be a disease that affects younger people more often, including children, though there have been cases in geriatric populations also. And there does be, in some ages, some gender issues like other autoimmune diseases with women being more affected, though anybody can, including boys and young men.
So it sounds like if I've got a young child whose mood all of a sudden shifts, whose ability to focus and concentrate all of a sudden shifts, as a parent, I'm likely to think that my child is going through a stage, is having a problem with a teacher or a friend. I am not very likely, I don't think, to go to an autoimmune issue.
Right, and you'd be right probably most of the time that it is a phase, or there's so many mental health issues, and children are obviously prevalent, as are educational and learning problems. I think the issue there again is that things seem to be exceptionally acute. There isn't any sort of leading period to it. Someone hasn't always had problems with their teachers, or someone hasn't had issues socializing or dealing with learning most of their kind of young career as a school-age child. And also, there's things that are more bizarre about their behavior, episodes of confusion, perhaps. And obviously, if there are any neurologic issues, it looks like absence seizures or big seizures, this would come up to the thinking more than just a phase or a learning disability.
Is it reasonable for a parent, upon recognizing that there's something unusual with their child, and perhaps they take their child to a doctor who does not look at the autoimmune issue, but immediately sort of diagnoses as, drug abuse or a psychiatric issue? Is it reasonable for that parent to insist on getting a second opinion if, in fact, the sense is that the behaviors are pretty new and pretty sudden?
This is another tough question, and part of our mission, whether it's as physicians or radio hosts, mental health practitioners, the Autoimmune Alliance, Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance, is really to raise awareness. I would hope that parents are truly all powerful, and parents, when listened to, usually know the information and usually have a sense of something being different about their child a lot better than their physicians. I think a parent who believes that their child has not been in trouble before, does not run in a crowd that has ever had issues with truancy or drug abuse, if we're talking about a teenager, and all of a sudden has acute changes that someone thinks is related to drugs of abuse and can't prove it, that a family really tries to have an open communication and dialogue with their physicians to say, hey, I read about this or I've heard about this. Do we have any concerns at all about the spectrum of disorders? I think the same thing goes with a younger child. Younger children don't seem to quite have the same type of cadence or trajectory of their symptoms as teenagers and young adults. So young children we've taken care of at Texas Children's will sometimes have an acute change in their development, a regression sometimes, acute language changes, so all of a sudden speaking less if they had language, irritability instead of psychosis, problems with their gait, and perhaps and more abnormal movements, and so things are different. But again, they're more acute, and they're not like what their child has gone through before. And yes, I think a parent has a responsibility, along with the pediatrician or family practitioner, to go the extra step to say, maybe there's something else here. Let's see who we can reach out to ask these questions.
Do you have a sense of a range of diagnoses that are not related to autoimmune encephalitis, but over time one discovers that they are? Someone likely to be diagnosed with depression, and then later on there's a discovery that, this is a little bit different from a course of depression.
Yeah. You're asking a lot of tough questions today. I guess that's why they keep you on the other side of the mic. I think we know a fair amount about NMDA receptor encephalitis and acute presentations. And as awareness gets better, I would like to think we diagnose children, teenagers, and young adults earlier than we used to in the past. I don't think we know enough about the chronic conditions or those children and young adults who were missed, who perhaps had this start. Maybe there weren't any seizures and people didn't notice that that's what they had. So the chronic picture, I think, is very difficult for me to talk about. I know in the acute presentations, kids and teenagers, the audience, the type of age groups I take care of, because I don't take care of adults, often are labeled as having their first break, if it's about psychosis, or obviously someone is searching really intently for drugs of abuse. Younger kids might be labeled as acute onset of autism, are the common sort of mental health issues that I see kids going to a psychiatric institution or even landing in the ER when the parents are really understanding that something, there was normal development before, and all of a sudden someone is telling them their child has a pretty severe neuropsychiatric disorder.
The behaviors and the symptoms that you're describing, they sound pretty scary. Is there a cure, or is it that once you have this diagnosis, you always have this diagnosis?
We've had some studies come through, and the last one from one of the experts in the field, Dr. Dalma in Spain, in 2013, tells us that if kids and adults start getting therapy within the first 4 weeks, that includes therapies like IV steroids, as you might see for inflammation, other diseases like asthma, IVIG, which stands for intravenous immunoglobulin. That is the clear part of the blood transfusion. It has lots of kind of good antibodies from pool donors and seems to turn down the immune system from attacking the body, or sometimes even more aggressive immune suppression that shuts off the body's ability to make bad antibodies. If those are given to a child or an adult early, then the thinking is that recovery, though it is a long marathon process, can be sustained, and perhaps up to 80% of people can make a good recovery with either no deficits or some mild deficits that don't seem to impair their function. So the data seems to be robust in that one disease, NMDA receptor encephalitis, although recovery time in the hospital can be 1 to 2 months, time in a rehab institution can be about the same, and then recovery on average can last even up to a year, and sometimes improvements may linger and be consistent for up to 18 months. Now, in other disorders that we understand, there are less kids and adults with some of the other antibodies, or perhaps antibodies we have yet to discover, we don't understand that trajectory. Sometimes patients aren't as sick and don't end up in the hospital, but sometimes their recovery and our ability to stop the immune system from attacking the body seems to be slower and less robust.
So I'm hearing some hope, certainly, in the fact that you're saying, at least with the awareness that you have now, there's a good chance that 80% of people will have what you've described as a good recovery, which might not be they're 100% back to where they were prior to this, but that they are good enough that they can lead full and productive lives the way that they would like.
That's correct. I think the time you have with me should be one filled with hope. I think hope that physicians will learn to talk to each other better, hope that physicians will learn how to communicate with parents in a much better fashion, and hope that if a medical institution and city can really get their act together. I think of these diseases as almost a stress test for a medical institution. If we can get our act together and really talk to each other and make diagnoses early, the experts in the field tell us that if we do all those things, we can really lead to robust outcomes, though with a lot of challenges in the initial diagnosis and therapy, and then a lot of challenges for doctors and families as we get through a recovery period that modern science doesn't understand quite yet.
What is the likelihood, particularly with teens, although in these days perhaps with young children as well, that the child might have an awareness of changes and seek to self-medicate with drugs or alcohol? Do you find that as a routine part of the diagnostic picture?
I really haven't yet. This seems to be different than some of the other systemic autoimmune disease I take care of, like lupus. Perhaps the lead-in period for this is longer, and perhaps kids have more awareness. I have not seen that teenagers really have awareness. Once this starts, they are really in the thick of things, and they are quite altered and quite quite difficult to sort of take care of. And then, thankfully, they're often amnestic to this. So for 2 to 3 months, the teenagers that I take care of really have no recollection of what happened to them until they really, the lights turn on in the hospital and they're better. And that's sometimes a couple of months after their event. So I've not really seen the kids will start going for alcohol or marijuana or other drugs of abuse, as they might do when they have severe ADHD or depression and they don't have a sense of how to get help, but they notice that illicit substances might calm them down or turn some of the demons off.
The idea that a child, someone could have an illness and lose a month or more of memory is really kind of fascinating and unnerving, I would think. On the one hand, the good news that they don't remember. On the other hand, not so good news because they've lost a piece of their life. Dr. Mescal, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to come back to you, and I'd just like you to speak about that piece, if you can, in terms of the potential for memory loss for folks with this disorder. We will be back again, as I say, in just a moment, and we will continue our conversation with Dr. Mescal, so don't you go away. Dr. Mescal, the sense of losing time, which for somebody who's just thinking about it from a psychiatric perspective raises all kinds of red flags. But as we were saying before, you know, maybe it's the good news and the bad news. What is your sense of that particular experience, if any of your patients have had it?
Yes, I've had some patients recently that really comment to that. There is definitely the good news that they don't remember their time in the intensive care unit if they spend time there. They don't remember procedures. They don't remember their parents being upset or distraught as they've gone through the highs and lows of getting a diagnosis and having to agree to medication. But then as they wake up and realize that they have some deficits, they're not at their best, because with NMDA receptor encephalitis, the disorder we understand best and see the most of, it takes really months for people to start approximating their previous pre-disease intellect and function. So they understand something's different, and then they're quite anxious, tearful, and scared that they can't remember, that time really has been wiped away, like a computer hard drive being wiped away by a hacker and malware. For the parents, it's also a mixed bag. They unfortunately don't have their hard drive erased. They will remember these times and what they've gone through in the war for the rest of their lives. They sometimes, though, are have a little bit of contentment that their child doesn't remember some of the intensities of inpatient hospitalization or any of the terrible behaviors that might have led to sadness on their parents' part or need to see psychiatrists or be in psychiatric institutions initially. So it truly is a mixed bag, just like you said, and you hit all those highlights of the various reasons that a human being who depends on memory is such a big part of who they are, to deal with the fact that memory seems to not be as robust as it should be.
Is there any way that one can avoid, be clear that they are doing everything that they can do, need to do, to avoid having this kind of an issue?
So unfortunately not. This is where the scientists are in high gear, and a variety of foundations like the Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance and similar organizations throughout the world are raising awareness and raising funds for research. We do not have a sense of why this happens to child A or adult B and not adult C. As a rheumatologist, I take care of other autoimmune diseases, and all I can tell families is that it's never their fault. As far as we know, this is not a diet issue. This is probably a mix of genetics, something that is inappropriately hardwired in someone's immune system. And then probably the bad luck of an infection. And often when an infection starts, the normal immune system will try to ward off the infection. And if any part of the immune system has rogue elements or is hardwired to sort of go off and do its own thing, and that's what happens. That is often the case with other autoimmune diseases I help take care of, such as lupus, another disease that can sometimes affect the brain.
Lupus is another one of those scary diagnoses that very often people certainly don't want to have, and then once they have it, don't particularly want to deal with it. With these autoimmune issues that you treat, you talked about medication in the hospital in the early stages. Is it also medication for life, or is it for the acute phase of treatment that medication is required?
Yeah, and I think physicians are trying to get closer to what their idea of best care practices or standard of care is for these conditions. For NMDA, I think internationally in the U.S., there are multiple work groups that are trying to really make sure we do things the same if there's any evidence to do so, and that's probably for the first couple of months. I think most physicians will have certain medications like that intravenous immunoglobulin for another few months, and then some of the experts are trying to tell us that we probably should stay on some form of immune suppression, as we do in other autoimmune disease such as lupus, for perhaps a year or 2 years, the time that perhaps a flare is most likely or a relapse. In NMDA, that relapse rate seems to be getting lower and lower as physicians write up more cases. As radio shows and mental health practitioners are educating themselves and learning about these diseases and leading to diagnosis earlier, because that relapse rate now in the most recent study from Dr. Dalma's group seems to be at about 12% during a two-year period, so a lot lower than people thought it used to be. It is not clear that this is about lifelong medications, unlike other diseases I take care of, like lupus, which is probably much more chronic and probably does require lifelong medication or close to lifelong. So this might be more of an acute immune insult and medications for months to years and not lifelong. So again, some of the deficits might require supportive interventions and psychotropic medications, such as stimulants. If someone has held on to ADHD features after their disease, or sometimes if people have held on to mood issues, perhaps they need to be on a mood stabilizer or an antidepressant as part of their support. And that sometimes does seem to linger more than the 2 years that we might use immune medication.
If and when someone experiences a relapse, do the symptoms look the same as they did with the first episode?
Yeah, they appear to be very much the same. The studies seem to tell us they're probably not as extreme or as total. So if someone presented with, being lethargic and having seizures and losing speech, and being in the ICU, the flare might be more about small seizures or perhaps a movement, a tremor coming back, but usually not as severe, though it probably can be all over the map.
Fascinating. Dr. Mescal, you have certainly given us a lot to think about and a lot to, quite frankly, do more study about. And it sounds like you are feeling hopeful that your colleagues are doing and will continue to do the work with the vigor that is necessary in order to get more answers for this. Is that a fair statement?
That is. I couldn't have said it better myself. I think we need to be hopeful about our medical professions, our mental health professions, our nurses, and know that in North America we have networks that are working together, rheumatologists, neurologists, in a partnership with psychiatrists and families, that we're going to ensure that there's optimal team-based care and family-centered care in our institutions, that we can make sure we make diagnoses early, have the difficult conversations about medications, and then obviously deal with all the challenges of the recovery period so people are back in their lives and families who are just have such impact. I'm just amazed by what families go through and how strong they are, that we get their kids back for them and they can get on with their lives.
Dr. Mescal, thank you so much for joining us today and really giving us a lot of information that I'm going to trust a lot of folks did not have. And again, folks, Dr. Mescal is a pediatric rheumatologist at Texas Children's Hospital and an associate professor at Baylor College of Medicine. And Dr. Mescal also serves as the director of the Pediatric Rheumatology Fellowship Program. Dr. Mescal, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to a parent who has been through many of the situations that you were describing. So again, Dr. Mescal, thank you very much for your time today.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you for having me on today.
All righty. Welcome back to this edition of Mind Talk Friday on the other side. Now I'd like to introduce you to our next guest, and his name is Jeff Bikos. And Jeff is a parent of a child who actually has been diagnosed with autoimmune encephalitis. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us here on Mind Talk today.
Well, Pamela, thank you very much for having me.
Jeff, your story, as I understand it, is harrowing a reasonable way to describe it? You and your wife went, and your daughter went through so much.
Oh, that absolutely. And we also have an older son, and he was also affected by this as well. And it's been the worst experience in our entire life, and one that I don't wish upon anybody. That's for sure.
There was a time that your life was fine. I want you to tell me about what life was like for the Bikos family before your daughter began to seem to change right before your eyes.
Sure. I would describe our life as very normal. We live in the suburbs about an hour north of Philadelphia. We have two children. It was the year 2013 where this all started, and our daughter Haley specifically was a high honor student, voted the most dedicated volleyball player on her team, played basketball, worked at a dog rescue, helped disadvantaged kids, and it was just very normal. I mean, we great friends, great, life was good and, doing all the right things. And then on July 5th of 2013 at 7:45 in the morning, that's when our lives collapsed. She came down for breakfast. I started making her breakfast. And then within about 15 seconds, she couldn't speak. And I thought she was having a stroke. But at 13 years old, that's just something. Like, how could that be? Because that just didn't sound right. But we got her to the Doylestown Hospital, and within about a minute of her getting into her room, she had a seizure. And that was really the beginning of the collapse of our lives. And subsequently, later that night, they did a lumbar puncture, and the doctors noticed that her white blood count was very, very elevated, and they weren't sure what to do. They thought it was encephalitis or meningitis, but not sure. So they ambulanced us down the next morning to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she just wasn't right. So we were on the neurological floor. And so that was Saturday morning. Then on Monday, the following Monday, she had two more seizures. And then on that Wednesday, she stopped breathing. So they intubated her. And then the following Wednesday is when she fell into a coma for just under 4 months. And at the time, the doctors really they weren't sure what was going on. They thought it was some sort of autoimmune disease, but they weren't sure. So they did another lumbar puncture, and that's when she was diagnosed with anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis.
It's bad enough when an adult goes to a doctor and the doctor says, "Gee, I'm not really sure."
Mm-hmm.
You never want to hear that from a doctor, although
right.
We often forget that they're human too. But you don't want to hear that. To hear that about your child, and then to be ambulanced from one hospital to another, what was going on for you, for your wife, for your son?
It was a total disbelief. We were like, on July 4th, we had just come back from the New Jersey shore and things were fine. Haley was healthy as an ox. And all of a sudden you're thrown into this chaotic situation where, she stops talking and then she has a seizure. And then, it just kept going downhill and downhill and downhill. And for the first week or two, your adrenaline kind of takes over, and you're just there, and you're trying to do whatever you can. And certainly as a dad, how do I help my child and what do I need to do? But, as soon as she stopped breathing, and then they ultimately had to put a tracheotomy in and a feeding tube in, and then no answers. I mean, I can't even describe how horrible this event was, because your life is shattered. And then the doctor's telling you, well, we're not quite sure what's going on. And then later on in our journey, they said, well, maybe she'll be in a coma for 2 years.
Oh,
and then
gosh.
A couple weeks after that, then, well, we're not sure if she's going to live. And so you're torn to shreds. You know, in this whole process, I also lost my job. Then I've got mounting medical bills. And I mean, it was like we were in a tornado and we weren't sure where we were going to stop and end up. And it's just mind numbing. It's really hard to describe how just sad and lonely and empty and lost and that we felt. And, you know, our friends and our community were there for us, but they couldn't really grasp the enormity of how sick she was and what was going on and just not knowing. And again, the doctors just not having any kind of clear idea on what was going on and what was happening. So it was just been the worst time in our life.
You know, it sounds breathtaking in not such a great way, even as you describe it. I mean, it just sounds like boulders on top of boulders,
mm-hmm.
of heartache and worry and stress. And how did your son deal with this?
I think it's been incredibly traumatic on him. He was interning for a company in San Francisco. He was just about ready to enter his junior year in college, and he came back to this, you know, horrific event, and he put his life on hold for about a year and a half. And my wife and I lived at the Philadelphia Ronald McDonald House for, you know, 254 days, and he was here by himself with our dog. So I think he kept a lot of things into himself. He tried to be very strong for my wife and I and for Haley, and I think he suffered in silence. And I mean, I think to this day it's really affected him, and you know, he just tries to be the stoic older brother. And you know, I mean emotionally it's scarred all of us for our whole lives.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think about the suddenness. I mean, I've got this picture of, you know, dad's in the kitchen, daughter's in the kitchen, everything's going fine. And then all of a sudden, I mean, literally within seconds, it sounds like Haley was different and your life was forever different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many times when things happen to children, parents ask themselves, what did I do? What should I have done differently? Did you and your wife go through any of that?
Oh, absolutely. We, you know, again, we were at the Jersey Shore, and she had a henna tattoo. And our first thought was, "Oh my gosh, what, you know, did that tattoo create this, you know, terrible event?" And then, of course, the doctors assured us that no, that had nothing to do with it. And then you rack your brains and trying to think about, you know, what did we miss? Were there any big behavioral changes and any of this stuff? And that's what makes this disease so complicated, is that Haley's case, she was struck down with it from a very medical perspective right away, versus many other people that contract this disease, where they notice behavioral changes, so changes with friends, you know, significant changes in school and any of that. I mean, and we just did not see any of that, and that's what was so perplexing. It's like what did we miss? You know, were any of her behaviors due to the disease, or was it because she was a 13-year-old teenage girl? You know, we still kind of rack our brains. It's like, what did we miss? And I think our final analysis is that, you know, it's just been a fluky thing and one of those 1 in 10 million scenarios that, you know, we had no control over, and we couldn't have done anything any different.
The idea that the doctors would tell you, I don't know, I do know, she could be in a coma for a year, she might not make it at all. That kind of stress can do many things to families. It can tear them apart, mm-hmm. Or it can bring them closer together. What was the impact on you, on your family, on your marriage?
Well, I think with my wife and I, we really rallied together and created this team environment with the folks at CHOP and really trying to work through this. You know, what do we need to be doing, you know, for Haley and, you know, informing the doctors of Haley before the disease so we could, you know, potentially treat her. I think, you know, now that we're home, I mean, it's incredibly stressful because it affects every cell in your body and every, I mean, from the financial aspect of it to the relationship piece of it to, I mean, just everything. And it's been really, really difficult. And we're, you know, I think we're working through a lot of those things right now. I mean, we're out of the woods on one hand, but on the other hand, you know, I think we're really struggling to figure out how we move forward, as a couple.
What is happening now? Haley went through so much, but she survived.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that journey.
I mean, it's just been an incredible journey in that, you know, once we got home, we were like, oh my gosh, you know, what do we do now? And how do we ensure that she continues this amazing recovery path? And we're working closely with the doctors. And I think if you were to meet her today, you would virtually not know that she was as sick as she was. And she's got her bright smile and her wit back, and she loves to kid around, and that has all come back, and her schoolwork has come back, and she actually was inducted into the National Honor Society last Thursday. So, it's an absolute miracle. I mean, it's the power of, you know, faith and prayer and medicine and just a lot of hard work when working with the doctors and, you know, trying to ensure success here.
When one first gets the kind of diagnosis that you and your family got, the idea that there could be another side and it could be so positive perhaps seems far away. How did you and your family manage to hold on to hope and energy and keep fighting for your daughter and pushing through this?
Oh, you know, I don't know how we did it, to be honest. You know, we just weren't going to let her die. You know, I think we were just saying, you know, we're not, I mean, we are going to do whatever we can to rally as a family, and we are going to work as hard as we can to do whatever we can with the doctors and with her. I think that's a hard question to answer because
sure.
I don't know what it was. You know, I mean, it's just like, we're not going to let her die.
Period.
Know?
Yeah, that's just a given. We're not going to let that happen.
Right.
You said that during this process, you lost your job. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you sort of knew was coming down the pike? Was it related to days away from work, or was it completely unrelated to what you were dealing with your daughter?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it was a complete shock. The company that I'd worked for when this first happened, they told me that, no, don't worry about everything. Just focus on your daughter and your job's secure and safe. And then, you know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks into it, and then they just gave up and they just said, no, we can't, you know, we need to run our business and, you know, this just isn't going to work. So they put me on Family Medical Leave Act and, you know, which doesn't do anything really. I mean, it just secures your job. But as things were starting to come back, you know, they didn't hire me back. So, and I didn't have much recourse at all. So again, that provided another level of stress because, you know, we've basically gone through everything in our family. So that, you know, that makes it incredibly challenging. So. But the good news is I have a great new job and things are working out fine and we're slowly rebuilding. So
the mounting insurance, I mean, the mounting hospital bills,
mm-hmm.
Was there help for your family in taking care of those? Was there any sort of program available at the hospital to help you? Was your daughter, in fact, eligible for, given the difficulty with her illness, Medicare or Medicaid or any kind of assistance?
Mm. Yeah, we were very lucky in that. We live in a small, tight knit community, and our state senator got involved in the case and was able to get us onto Pennsylvania Medicare. And so that took a lot of the pressure off, you know, the financial pressure off, so we could just focus on Haley and getting her healthy. But it's, you know, it's a really frustrating, it was hard to do that. And, you know, we didn't do anything wrong. You know, we just woke up one morning and our lives changed. And, you know, I get really angry about that. I mean, nobody in this country should have to go through these kind of financial crises because of a healthcare situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance. How did that come into being, come into your lives, or you into that organization?
Sure. Well, you know, as Haley was first diagnosed with anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, I mean, there really isn't much literature. And of course, you start, you know, doing internet searches and trying to find as much information to help the doctors as possible. And there, you know, there's just lots of just crazy stuff online, as you know, well are well aware of.
Right.
And I think it was just by happenstance that I came across the AE Alliance website, and the organization is very committed to providing the right kind of information and background about the disease. And, you know, I just found their resources to be very helpful and kind of comforting as we were kind of at the tail end of Haley's hospital visit. And so, you know, now that we're home and finding our new normal, you know, I want to help the organization as much as I can, because as a parent, you're so lost and you don't know what to do. You don't know where to turn to, and you just don't know what your life is going to be like. And, you know, I think this organization is really doing a very great job on trying to provide that support and help in research for parents and the medical community as well.
What is the new normal in the Bikos household?
Well, I think the new normal is just, you know, one, trying to make sure that Haley doesn't relapse, and to, you know, support her in her recovery and her help. I think as her brain is healing, she still suffers from a little bit of cognitive fatigue. So she works really hard at school, and then when she comes home, she's completely exhausted. And you know, the doctors are telling us that, you know, just with time, as all of the receptors kind of reconnect and she, you know, gains more and more strength, you know, that should kind of go away. And then the other piece is just, you know, from the economic side, you know, working again and just trying to rebuild after, you know, a 2-year kind of hiatus from working, and then, you know, rebuilding the relationship. So there's a lot of, you know, those are kind of the three pillars of our new normal and what we need to do, or what we're doing to work to try to, you know, rebuild. So,
has your son resumed his education?
He has. I'm proud to say that he graduated from Temple University this past May and has a wonderful job working in New York City. And, I mean, he's the unsung hero in this whole thing. So I'm really proud of how he's been able to manage, you know, his life and start living his life. So, you know, it's a good, I'm really proud of him.
So many times when there are crises within the family, the children or the siblings don't get thought about or focused on in a way that would really be useful, not only for that individual child, but for the family as well. Mm-hmm. Jeff, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk, folks. We'll be right back. Jeff, you talked about the family being mindful of Haley not having a relapse. Is there anything that you can actually do to prevent a relapse? There was nothing that you did to cause the illness to arise in the first place.
Right. No, there's really nothing that you can do, because you don't know what her immune system is doing, and you know, we're just very mindful that of watching, you know, for the signs that you know, is she forgetful? You know, can she repeat sentences? You know, that's a really hard part, because now she's 16 years old and teenage girls are going through all sorts of things, and you know, sometimes we kind of chuckle and say, well, is this the disease or is this just being a teenage girl?
You know? Right. Teenage girls repeat themselves and forget things, except their BFF's phone number. But other than that, they forget
right,
everything.
Right. yeah, you know, so we work closely with the doctors down at CHOP, and she sees them a couple, maybe two or three times a year, and we do some blood work and MRIs, and you know, we just try to stay on top of it. And I think at some point, you know, she'll be, you know, cleared of all of this. But we just, you know, again, we just don't know, and that whole uncertainty of not knowing is, you know, as a parent, is just incredibly challenging and frustrating.
Of course. You've referred to CHOP a couple of times. That is the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Oh, correct. Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yep.
You've also referred to the Ronald McDonald House.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was a lifesaver. I mean, my wife and I were in the hospital for, you know, 18 to 20 hours a day for months, and you're mentally and physically exhausted, and you know, after that, we were just able to go back to the house, and you know, we had a very safe, secure room, and there was always food there for us, and we could just kind of try to take care of ourselves. And you know, when you go through this, I mean, you don't take care of yourself, and so you know, the stress levels are very high, and you don't eat right, and all sorts of stuff. And you know, the house is just amazing in what it does for families, and then you talk to other families that are going through crazy things as well. And, you know, you gain that support and strength from the other families as well. It's an amazing organization that I think a lot of people, I think they know about it, but they don't really understand how it really helps families, you know, when they go through these times of crisis.
I think you're right. Now, the reason that you and your wife were there was you had to move to a different location in order to be close to your daughter.
Correct.
And when you moved into what was the process for you getting into the Ronald McDonald House?
Well, the social worker at the hospital knew that we were going to be in for a long and uncertain journey, and he just said, you can't, you know, at the time my wife was sleeping on the couch in Haley's room, and you know, I was sleeping in the reclining chair, and you know, you just can't do that. I mean, you can do it for a week or two because you're running on adrenaline. But after that, I mean, you can't. It's just impossible, because you really have to take care of yourself as well as a parent, right? You got to be healthy, and you need to recharge your batteries, you know, so you can fight another day. And so he was kind enough to reach out to the social worker at the Philadelphia Ronald McDonald House. And fortunately, a family was leaving, and we were able to secure that room. And then we called that Ronald McDonald House our home for 254 days.
The numbers are etched in your memory.
Oh, yeah.
7:45 a.m. in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
254 days.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's a comfort, or do you feel like you want to try to back away from that kind of specificity of detail?
You know, I that's a really good question. There's parts of me that I want to forget the whole episode, because it was just so horrible.
Yeah.
But I say that, and I share that with people, because there has been a positive outcome with Haley, and we're talking to another family whose daughter's been diagnosed with the same disease, and for the mom and dad to see Haley today and seeing that there's a real positive outcome, I think just is giving them hope, or what they've shared with us is that it gives us hope that their daughter will be okay at the end of the day. And so I think that's why I share those numbers with people, because it's awful, but the outcome can, and you know, be very positive.
And certainly in Haley's case, it has been extremely positive.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep.
Is there a first or a second step that you would urge parents to take, even at if they're at the beginning of this journey and their child is having these symptoms that nobody seems to quite understand? Looking back on the process that you and your wife went through, is there any guidance that you would share with families today or individuals today?
Well, I think, I mean, in our case, we were extremely lucky because the disease was discovered at University of Pennsylvania Hospital, which is right next door to Children's Hospital. And so the neurology team has had a fair amount of experience in this disease. And one of the neurologists, you know, in her gout was just kind of saying, I think this is what Haley has. I think what's really important today is for parents to kind of stand firm and communicate with the medical community, because the medical community has a really hard time diagnosing this disease. A lot of it is psychological. So in behavioral issues, so sometimes they think the kids are on some sort of drug, and you know, they tend to put them maybe in a psych ward initially, but that's not necessarily the case. There's so much more going on, and so it's really kind of being, you know, firm in working with the medical team on their child and what's kind of going on, and don't settle for, well, we don't know, or you know, we think it's this, and when your gut is kind of, as a parent, telling you something totally different, I mean, it's really hard.
Don't settle on we don't know. I think that's probably
right.
The best advice that you could give anybody about mostly anything. Don't settle
mm-hmm.
on we don't know.
Right.
Jeff, because would you like to share with us any contact information for the Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance, or can one just search for it on the web?
Yeah, I think it's aealliance.org.
Okay.
And again, if it's the Autoimmune Encephalitis Alliance.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your story, your family's story, with us here at Mind Talk. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, or if you have any comments about today's conversation, send me an email, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. All programs are available at the Mind Talk site on demand, so make sure that you visit the site often. There's always something new to listen to, always something new to learn. And folks, I want you to remember too, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.